Welcome, everyone, to a very special episode of Podcasting Him Softly. This is Nick. I am, of course, joined by Frank. Hey, Frank.
Hello.
And today we're really excited to be able to get Sean Mullen on the show today. Sean is a West Point graduate and the writer-director of this year's independent romance, Amira and Sam. It's a very touching movie, a lot of heart, and it's his first feature film as a writer-director and was executive produced by James Ponsoldt, who also happened to direct the spectacular Now from a few years ago, which is another excellent movie that sort of flew under the radar. And Amira and Sam, for people not familiar, is a New York set story focusing on an Iraq war vet named Sam, played by Martin Starr, who many people know from HBO's Silicon Valley. Here, very cleaned up in much different form. Very refreshing to see him like that. And it's basically how he meets a charming girl named Amira, played by the wonderful Dina Shihabi, if I'm saying that correct, and I hope I am. And she's an illegal immigrant from Iraq who happens to be the niece of his wartime translator. And before you can say meet cute in classic romantic comedy drama territory, the two of them form an unlikely friendship, which quickly blossoms into a romance, which then leads them down some really unexpected emotional paths with a really, really satisfying conclusion. The movie played the festival circuit, won some awards. Drafthouse Films grabbed the distribution rights. And after it had a limited theatrical release earlier this year, it's now available on various platforms on, let's see here, we got Amazon, and I know it's on Vudu, and there will be, I believe, an exclusive deal coming up with another provider. I think it was Amazon. Is that correct, Sean?
Yeah, Amazon Prime starts, I think, right after 4th of July.
Excellent. So thank you very much for coming on the show. And again, I'm very excited to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. Thanks for, you know, supporting the movie.
Of course.
Absolutely, man. It was I just watched it fresh prior to the podcast, and I enjoyed it very, very much. I thought it was a very touching love story, and I was engaged the entire time. And I absolutely love Martin Starr. I think he's hilarious, and I loved the casting of him in this film. It felt very genuine and touching, and it was interesting to see him in this light because I'm used to seeing him most recently in Silicon Valley, where he plays the introverted, doesn't really talk much, and has awkward dialogue, the awkward comic relief. I think he's great in that, but I absolutely loved seeing him in this film, and that was fantastic. How did you come to choose him?
Well, it's interesting, you know, I think the movie started with this idea that, you know, I feel like Hollywood, you know, every single veteran coming home from war movie has always been about a veteran grappling with post-traumatic stress. And so from the start, I wanted to make a different film about a soldier who comes home and he's fine, but the country has PTSD, basically, from September 11th. And I thought that was a fresh take. And in line with that, I wanted to cast somebody, you know, everybody in Hollywood thinks, you know, if you're in the military, you basically look like Channing Tatum. And yeah, I mean, there's a few of those guys in the military, of course. But, you know, a majority of the military is, you know, it's a cross section of America. And there's all different types of guys. And a lot of the special forces guys I know are really just buff nerds. You know, they're just really just like really in shape, you know, smart dudes.
Right.
And so I'm like, I was on, you know, looking for a buff nerd. You know, Martin is, you know, top of that list, I think. You know, I mean, the buff nerd list doesn't get much play out here in Hollywood. Yeah. But if they ranked him, I think he's probably one, right? I don't know. So yeah, he's just amazing, and he's just. I mean, the thing with Martin, to be completely honest, was I knew I needed somebody funny. You know, it's a comedic role. You know, it's a comedic. You know, it's a love story, but you know, the comedy. If the comedy did not work in the movie didn't work. I knew that, so I leaned towards casting somebody that I knew could pull up the comedy. And with Martin, you know, he hadn't done anything more dramatic or a love story, but he's everything I've ever seen him in, he's never hit a false note. I've never ever seen him hit a false note. And I didn't know why he, after acting for 15 years, why he would start hitting false notes with me, you know? So you just have to have that confidence, I think, as a director to just have the faith in it. And it also got Martin excited. I mean, I had to convince him to take the role a little bit. You know, he's like, our first meeting, you know, he's like, I like the script, but you know, are you sure I'm your guy? I'm like, I'm definitely sure you're my guy. So,
well, it's probably been hammered in his head for the last, like, you know, 10, 12 years that he's only right for one role. And just because he's been typecast, unfortunately, he does that role so well. And I think for me, just one of the most surprising aspect was how exciting it was to see him cleaned up, good looking, with kind of some biceps, you know, like a different, it was like a totally different Martin Starr. And, you know, he really killed it, I think. And he kills it every week when Silicon Valley's on air, and he killed it in Adventureland. I just like that movie's a really wonderful movie. And he just brought so much to that third guy role that you might not get from another actor who could still do a nice job, but it's not going to do the Martin Starr job. So it was definitely nice to see him get a chance to flex his muscles and do something different. And to say nothing of how wonderful the chemistry that he had with, and I want to make sure that I'm saying that her name right, with Dina Shihabi. Is that how you say it?
Yeah, Dina Shihabi. Yep, that's her, yep.
Yep. And how did you guys come across, how did you come across Dina? Was there a casting thing that went on, or did you know her from something else, or?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think with Dina, I mean, Dina's a whole other story. I mean, I think, you know, just with the two of them in general, it's funny, I was asked, when the movie was being released, I was asked to do a bunch of, like, writing, you know, and some, you know, write up some pieces to put out some press or, you know, articles and stuff like that. And I remember I was kind of overwhelmed, and I had to write one about how did I cast the two of them. And I just came up with this kind of cheesy idea that it was really kind of the airport model, if you're going to use a really bad analogy. But it's like I was really focused on arrivals and departures, and the idea of Martin being a departure, you know, from his standard role, and then, you know, Dina just being an arrival. I mean, she was in graduate school at the time. She wasn't even done with graduate school. She was between her second and third year at NYU's MFA program. She's born and raised in the Middle East, Middle Eastern. She, you know, speaks fluent Arabic, and she, you know, emigrated to New York City when she was 18. She had a lot of very similar characteristics, and you know, I saw my casting director, you know, he put out a huge, it was Billy Hopkins. That was like the first piece of the puzzle. When the movie started coming together, was getting Billy on board was a huge piece. He's a very famous casting director out of New York City. He did all the Oliver Stone's movies. He did Shakespeare in Love.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I don't know. He's big time. So he was the first.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he was the first, you know, first guy to kind of believe in the movie, and he came on board. And so he sent out a, you know, casting call, you know, and I was getting people putting themselves on tape all around the world, actually, people from, you know, Europe and the Middle East. And you know, I looked at probably 50 or 60 auditions, and you know, most of them were pretty good. You know, well, I didn't say most, you know, about half of them were pretty good, half of them weren't really good. But one was just popped above all. It wasn't even a competition. It was her. It was Amira. You know, I just knew it. It was her. She just popped off the screen, and then I called her in for audition in person, and she was just even more incredible in person. And I just knew, and you know, as a director, you just have to go with your intuition. I mean, a lot of times that's all you have. And so with Martin, you know, I just knew Martin would be good, but it was a leap of faith a little bit in this role, and it was a little bit of a leap of faith with Dina. And they didn't even, you know, the chemistry, a lot of times if this is a big studio movie, you know, the studio's right putting so much money on this thing, they would do chemistry reads for months and get everything ready. But this is an indie film. We didn't have any time or money. So they met 3 days before the shoot, you know, like that we met and we shot. So, you know, they didn't have much time.
Wow. So it was not a big rehearsal process?
No.
Nothing. It was not even a day or two or anything.
I had him for a week. No, I had him for a week, but it was like within that week, I mean, I had to, within the 5 or 6 days before shooting, I had to, you know, finalize, you know, locations, wardrobe. I still had to raise 30% of the money. I was busy. So, you know, we went through the script, you know, a few times we just read it through the script, you know, with the two of them. And also we read through the script, a few scenes with Bassam, who's played by Laith Nackley. He's the uncle. He's a very talented, he was the first actor I attached to the script. I had worked with him. He was the lead in my thesis film. I got my, master's degree at Columbia University in New York City, and he was the lead in my thesis film called Sadiq. And so he was attached from the beginning. And then you know, we went through it. We had a few days together, but you know, her and Martin hit it off right away, and they were just, you know, just kind of, they just are amazing. And then there's a really long bed scene in the movie, like a 7.5 minute take, no cuts. I don't know if you remember that scene in the movie.
But, yeah, that was great.
Yeah, and it's just like, I mean, it was really incredible. Like, that's when I kind of knew, maybe about halfway through the shoot, when we pulled off that scene, I was like, okay, this is going to work, you know?
Yeah, no.
Their chemistry, you know, that chemistry there. Yeah.
Absolutely. They really did have great chemistry, and you would have assumed that maybe there would have been more prep, because they really did feel, you know, so bonded together. And there's so many movies where the romance feels artificial or tacked on or created by, you know, who's hot in the market and whatnot. And obviously this film, a movie that comes from, I would have to assume, a personal place to some degree. It's an independent movie to its truest sense. So you really get the sense that these people are invested in their role and they care. And I think that, you know, without their level of commitment, you know, obviously the material around them is compelling enough, but they just brought so much to it that you can't really, after seeing the film, you sort of can't picture anybody else, especially because you get Martin to play, quote, you know, against type or against what everybody wants him to play.
So when I was watching the film, one thing that I really enjoyed was the character of Jack and the interaction of Jack and Sam. And before we get into how much I love Jack and the genesis of that casting, I thought I caught a Network reference there.
Oh,
further dialogue, right?
Absolutely. Nice work. Yes.
I know. I started laughing out loud when that happened. That's what I was, it was like one of those moments where it was just like, yes, I loved it.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. Yeah, that's a total, there's a few little, I like to call them, I guess, homages to different films. I mean, there's like there's the Manhattan, right, you know, shot, right, of course, by the bench, the two of them.
Yep.
And then, Network, absolutely. I always loved that joke. I always thought that was so, I don't know, I wanted to find a way to kind of sort of make it my own. So I'm good catch.
Yeah, man, that was perfect. I absolutely loved it. I sent Nick a message right away, and I was like, I was like, man, Network reference, awesome. So, yeah, how did the casting of Jack come about?
Well, David's an amazing actor. He's in New York City. He does a lot of just really great stuff. I mean, he was on this TV show back in like the 80s, or I don't know, that, you know, it was called Sledgehammer. I don't know. And so, you know, he was really popular for a long time in the 80s. And then, you know, ever since then, he's just done amazing, amazing stuff. He was in, really some really funny stuff, too. Like, I know he did, like, In the Loop, which is a great film, if you haven't seen that. And, mm-hmm. and some other, you know, just a lot of great things. And everything I've seen him in, I just thought he was really incredible. But he had the gravitas that was kind of needed to pull off the role, but also, like, the softer side to him. And he kind of reminded me of a lot of guys I know who are kind of that era, that Vietnam vet era turned kind of financiers in New York City. I it may seem like a small niche, but I know a lot of those guys, apparently.
Yeah, absolutely. I loved him in Burn After Reading.
Yes,
I thought he was
yes.
fantastic and absolutely hilarious. And so it was great to see him.
Yep.
It was great to see him in this role. I loved it. It was, you know, it was a treat. I always love in films when great character actors like him show up. It's always that added bonus.
Yeah.
You know, it's perfect.
Yeah, he's great. It's great. I mean, it's great. Another great reason to shoot in New York City and get an actor like that for one. You know, we shot all of his scenes. You know, he had three scenes in the film. We shot all scenes in one day, you know? So,
oh, that's awesome.
You know, you get him for a day.
And that's another thing that you pay attention to during the making it, you know, watching the film, is that it feels like a New York City movie. Was this movie completely shot on location? And given that New York has a reputation of being expensive, you know, how does a small production pull off, you know, filming in New York if you did?
Well, I lived in, I mean, I kind of have a, I'm really, I'm tethered to the city in many ways, you know, emotionally very deeply. And in a lot of other ways, my father was born in Brooklyn, but, and then I, and grew up in Long Island, and I went to undergraduate up the river, up at West Point. And so anytime I could jailbreak from West Point, I would go on down in the city, you know, and wreak havoc down there. And so I just loved New York City forever. And then I ended up going to – I kind of had this weird experience where I was on active duty in the National Guard – or I'm sorry, on active duty in Germany for a couple of years as an artillery officer. And I transferred to New York City in the summer of 99, and I started doing stand-up comedy and improv theater. And I was in the New York National Guard, which is just one weekend a month. There's a big armory, actually, on the east side of Manhattan. And so I was doing one weekend a month there and started doing comedy. And there's an improv theater in the city called the Upright Citizens Brigade, UCB Theater, which is it took off. I mean, Amy Poehler, you know, is one of the founders, and it really blew up. But it was just getting started when I was there. And so I was studying there and performing there, and then September 11th happened, and I was the plans officer for New York City, for Manhattan, as a lieutenant, and I got promoted to captain and put down at Ground Zero. So I ended up spending about 12 hours a day at Ground Zero as the officer in charge of the soldiers at Ground Zero, and I did stand-up comedy and improv theater at night, and so that was a crazy, crazy experience. So I have very strong ties to New York City. And then while I was down at Ground Zero, the spring of 2002, after I was down there for, you know, the better part of a year, I got accepted to graduate school at Columbia University, which is uptown there in Manhattan. And I went to grad, and I resigned from the military and I went to graduate school at Columbia. So I say all this, and I have very strong ties to New York City. I know all five boroughs very, very well. I mean, while I was in graduate school, I was driving a limo at night, or I was, you know, tending bar all over the city. So I know Manhattan, especially inside and out. And so when I was going to make a movie, I really wanted to, you know, have the film. I wanted the third main character, really, in all honesty, to be New York City. You know, so I was, you know, the locations were very carefully chosen. I mean, and going out in the river and jumping in the river and just really, you know, a lot of people forget Manhattan's an island, you know, and I really wanted to showcase that. And I went as far to thematically kind of underpin each character to a different borough. So you've got, you know, you've got the Wall Street cousin, you know, played by Paul Wesley, you know, and he's very much Manhattan. I mean, he represents money, kind of old establishment. And so his character is always a Manhattan, and that was his kind of borough. And then you've got, Dina Shahabi's character, you know, Amira, she's this kind of, feisty, you know, immigrant for, you know, kind of refugee really from Iraq. And so, you know, I put her down in, you know, over in Brooklyn, and then, you know, you got, and then, did you catch me there? I lose you? I'm sorry. And then,
no, you're good.
And then, of course, then you've got Sam's character, which is, you know, Staten Island, which is like the forgotten borough, and this idea that veterans have kind of been forgotten. So I love the idea that, like, he's the outcast, kind of forgotten, you know, borough of Staten Island being a vet. So, and then there's a bridge in New York City. There's tons of bridges in New York City, but the one I feel like is totally underplayed in films is the Verrazano Bridge, which is a very, very gorgeous, gorgeous bridge. It's a gateway to America, really. It's the first one you get when you're coming in from the Bay. And it's, and it connects Staten Island to Brooklyn. It goes from Sam's neighborhood to Amir's neighborhood. So it's this idea visually of connecting these two outsiders, you know. I think at its heart, the film is about outsiders. You know, and so I really use the terrain of the city to hopefully reinforce that.
Yeah, you absolutely did. It does take on its sort of third character element. And, you know, part of that is your obvious knowledge and love of the city, and also how the movie was shot. It doesn't, you know, you mentioned the long 6 or 7 minute take there, which during the film, which is great. And I'm also, weren't there multiple sort of longish takes that you employed? I seem to remember more than a few that lasted long. Tell me, how did you arrive at your aesthetic choices and, you know, working with the cinematographer? Because, you know, you gave New York this great, you know, you gave New York a great look without ever feeling, you know, too handheld or too, you know, too fake doc style for a small, you know, ground level movie such as this.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm very particular. I mean, I shot list everything, and I everything is very, I don't do a lot of coverage. You know, I don't over cover things. Like, I won't, if I'm shooting a scene, I'm not just going to shoot a wide, a master, a medium, a close on everybody at the dinner, you know, like that's not to me, and then figure it out in the edit room. I mean, a lot of people do that. They'll, you know, a lot of people will go shoot a scene with two or three cameras and just cover everything and then go figure out in the edit. But to me, I mean, that's just not where I derive a lot of the pleasure. For me, it's really figure out what's the scene about, you know, how is the text going to inform, you know, the blocking, which is then going to inform the camera and the movement. And, you know, every time I cut, I either cut on either an action or an emotion as well. So I don't cut arbitrarily. I feel like everything needs to be motivated. And that was my main, you know, the main thing I had when I sat down with all my keys, you know, my cinematographer and my production designer and stuff, I said, everything just needs to be motivated. You know, that's the main thing. So, you know, whether it was Danny Vecchione, who's my cinematographer, and he's really just such an incredible guy. And you know, every single, like he got into it after the first, you know, it took a few days, but then he really understood. We had a little language between ourselves, but, you know, every single shot in the film hopefully is motivated and is, you know, as well as every single cut, you know?
Right. Certainly. You just spoke briefly, well, a little bit ago about your background in improv and stand up. And I imagine that was the basis of your cameo in the film.
The basis of my cameos in the film was we just don't have any money, really. the real basis. I mean, yeah, when you're shooting in it, so we shot the film in over 17 days, you know, 16 and a half days roughly over 3 weeks. So we didn't, you know, it was very tight shooting schedule. So, what you do when you do an independent film is you always have what's called a cover set. You know, you always have basically, which is one day. You have one day that you can like, you put it at the end of the shoot and you you stick. It's your last shooting day, but you have it there. So if there's bad weather someday or a location falls through or there's an issue, you can pop it up like the next day. And so our stand-up comedy, we had access to the stand-up comedy venue because I used to do stand-up comedy there. And so we could shoot there whenever we wanted, really. And so during the day, so I had a tough time casting that stand-up MC because date was, you know, I was worried about the date switching too much. And so I just decided to do it myself. Yeah. But yeah, I did stand up for 5 or 6 years in New York, and I'm really comfortable up on stage, and I miss it a lot. I haven't, you know, I've been focusing on writing and directing the past few years, but I miss it. Yeah.
Yeah, that was great. It's always fun to see, directors with their Hitchcockian cameos. I always enjoy that. You know, I like Scorsese's cameo in Taxi Driver. Well, both of his cameos, I guess.
Yeah,
I loved it.
Yeah, Linklater's got a great one in Slacker. You know, I don't know. I always like that one. So, you know, I don't know.
Who are some of, and just, you know, while we're on the subject of other filmmakers, because this was your first film and it felt very much like a new voice. I mean, it had some influences here and there. Who are some of your inspirations when you were growing up and some of the filmmakers that you really were excited to see a new film from?
Oh man, it's tough. You know, I kind of had two phases of, you know, film. I mean, when I was a real kid, I mean, I was growing up in the 80s. So it was, I mean, and I didn't really separate film from any other kind of visual medium. So I just, you know, I watched a lot of comedies, you know, Caddyshack, Fletch, you know, all those movies were the movies I probably was raised on the most, to be honest with you. But then something happened to me when I was off in college, and I, in the mid 90s, you know, rolled around and you started seeing Clerks and Swingers and Slacker and, you know, all these, movies started coming out, and you're like, oh, wow, these are just guys out there making movies. You just go grab a camera and go do it. And there was this, you know, so that kind of indie resurgence of the 90s really motivated me a lot. And then I kind of had my third wave, I guess, when I got into grad school at Columbia. I really freaked out when I got accepted to Columbia because I'd gone to West Point. I had no formal film training. I don't know how I really got in there. I just wrote, you know, I wrote some samples and I made a short film, and I guess they liked the short film and they accepted me. And I showed up and I just felt really under prepared. And, you know, looking around the room and, you know, I have these award-winning kind of like prodigy filmmakers who, you know, all turned out to be, you know, even to this day, you know, I went to school with, Jennifer Lee, who wrote and directed Frozen. I mean, James Ponsolt was my EP, you know, he was did Spectacular Now. A lot of these really big filmmakers that were in the room that ended up, you know, this is Felipe Barbosa. I was the first guy I sat next to. He was a big time Brazilian director that I love. And so anyways, I could feel the insecurity really seeping in. So I freaked out and I watched every movie I could watch, really. I mean, I really fell in love then with different eras. You know, of course, the French New Wave is amazing, but I like the kitchen sink stuff, you know, I like the, the angry, angry young men kind of cinema too. Powell Pressburger stuff was big. You know, Saturday Night, Sunday Morning, The Sporting Life. Those were big movies, I think, for me. I don't know. And then in Hal Ashby, and I found Hal Ashby, and I didn't know who Hal Ashby was, and so I went to film school, and then I absolutely fell in love, and he's one of my all-time favorites. And then, Linklater, of course. I mean, my favorite trilogy, a lot of people talk about trilogies, Star Wars, this. My favorite trilogy, hands down, is the Before trilogy with Linklater. I mean, I just was blown away. A lot of long takes there, very deliberate filmmaker.
Yes.
Before
trilogy is wonderful, and you could, you know, you can – some of the walking and talking aesthetic of that movie blend, you know, rubbed off, I would say, on Amira and Sam. And I think that is one of the best trilogies ever put on film. And, Linklater has just been one of our most consistently underrated, you know, filmmakers for the last 20 plus years. It only just, you know, just recently the Academy wakes up and says, oh, wow, this guy's been making, he's just made a great movie. So I'm glad to see that he's finally gotten some, you know, recent cred, and I'm with you. You know, I had a chance, and I know, you know, Frank and I both did artistic stuff in school. I had a chance to do film school stuff, never made any of my own personal films, but I'm right there with you as a child of the 80s, you know, product of the 80s, growing up with those kind of comedies. So it's nice to see sort of a blend of your ability to get laughs, but also go for the emotional and for the, you know, for the dramatic, which is really nice. And he's like, it's just a really good blend of it.
Yeah, that's very important to me. I mean, I'm really a big believer in blending comedy and drama, because to me, that's life. I mean, life isn't all funny and it's not all dramatic. It's a mix. And if you can find a way to blend those two together, I feel like that's the most potent mix out there. I mean, I'm a big Billy Wilder fan, too. He's done a lot of great stuff over the years, some dramatic stuff and some comedic stuff. I'm just trying to think of other directors. There's a movie, I think my favorite movie of all time is a very little seen movie called Ballad of a Soldier. It's a 1959 Russian film. And if anybody watches that film and watches Amir and Sam, they'll definitely see the connection. I highly recommend Ballad of a Soldier. It's a really, just a great love story set in war-torn Russia, and it's a whirlwind love affair. And you know, so I don't know. I just went, all these influences kind of just came pouring in. Obviously, Woody Allen, too, you know, being in New York and being a New York lover. I mean, all of his stuff, really had an impact. So I just took from everywhere. I took from all over the place. I love the Dardenne brothers. I don't know. Are you guys fans of the Dardenne brothers from Belgium?
Yes.
The Promise, yeah. The Sun. Yeah. So those were big. I saw those in film school, and those films actually were like one of those moments that blew me away, as far as like, wow, you can do this, you know?
Yeah. One of the things, while I was watching the film, for me, it's not difficult, but, you know, especially a film that deals with themes like this, that's post 9/11. A lot of the times I think that's a fine line to walk. And you spoke of your background going to West Point and stuff like that, and your service a little bit, and it kind of reminds me of Rod Lurie as a filmmaker, and how with his films like Nothing But the Truth or The Last Castle, he adds validity to the film due to his background, because Rod Lurie also went to West Point like you did. You know what I mean? And I knew while watching this, I had looked up your background and stuff like that, and it just felt real.
Yeah, thanks.
If you understand what I'm saying, you know what I mean? It doesn't feel forced, or it doesn't feel like it's arbitrary or anything like that. It feels very genuine.
Yeah, thank you. Well, thank you. So, I mean, that's the goal. Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah. So that's one thing I was taking from it. Go ahead, Nick.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, and given that this movie is so particular, and because it was, I mean, this is your voice through and through. How did you, once you had this script written, how did you go about getting it made in today's independent movie climate?
I mean, it was suicidal, really. I mean, I kept flying to New York City with a script saying I'm going to make this movie, and then I would come back to LA and figure out what the hell I was talking about and how to do it. And I just kept going back and I just, you know, I just kept selling people, you know, you got to, in order to make an independent film, you have to get people so excited about the project that they really feel like if they're not a part of it, they're missing out. They're going to miss the train. They're going to miss the boat. And so, you know, I got the budget so low. I mean, that's the trick. You need to get the budget to such a point that you can get investors to say, you know what, this is going to be worth the ride. I mean, this is going to be worth the ride, both financially as well as, you know, creatively and emotionally and just everything. And so I got I was able to get the budget to a break point where, you know, investors were like, this is a good opportunity. You know, this is a great opportunity. And this guy's obviously passionate. And, you know, I'd done three short films in grad school and they'd won awards and done well. And I was very grateful for that, but it wasn't enough. You know, you need to have a feature under your belt, you know, and so I don't know. I mean, it's a tough question to answer. It was a process. I mean, I write very quickly. I mean, but at the same time, the script, probably had about 33 drafts of the script in the 18 months leading up to production, you know, just 33 different revisions. I kept writing, rewriting and making it better. And then I met with Martin. I rewrote it. I met with Dina. I rewrote it. I just kept revising and revising, and I kept chasing it. And then we finally, once we got Martin to say yes, then, I mean, once you have an actor say yes, then you have to set a date, you know, and then you really have to, all the people you've been talking to about money, you have to say, okay, we've been talking about money, but I actually need those checks. And then you get the checks and, you know, and you don't get all of them, you know, and then you have to cut more. And, you know, it was initially a 4-week shoot, which I was kind of, you know, thought I could pull off. And then I had to chop a whole week off it, you know, a couple months before production to go down to 3 weeks to be able to make the movie. But, you know, as an indie filmmaker, you have to do it. I mean, now I'm in a position now, I feel like with this under my belt and I've got good agents now at UTA, they've been getting me out there and I feel like I've got a bunch of projects coming up now that I'm hoping, you know, knock on this Skype thing here. I'm hoping the next one's a little more fluid.
Nice. Well, we'll get into that maybe towards the end, but I definitely want to bring up because it is very, very noteworthy. And you know, your film had the distinction of playing at a variety of film festivals. I know that it won, I think, two awards at the Napa Valley Film Festival last year, correct?
Yeah, I mean we won Napa. We won the Jury Award, which Christine Bichon gave out, which was really awesome because she's been a kind of a New York City hero of mine.
She's one of the voices. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and she loved the movie, and so she gave us the Jury Award, and then we won the Audience Award there. Yeah, we won. We played at 15 festivals last fall, and we won Best Film at 8 of them. So it was pretty incredible.
Oh, that is incredible, and I would say that. One of the most recent honor that you got, you know, bestowed upon you and, you know, your film and yourself is the inclusion of the, and I want to make sure I'm saying this right, the Got Your Six campaign, which is something I'd like you to tell us about because it, from what I've been able to gather, it's an award that's given to film and television programs that accurately depict veterans in the media and essentially make a point to show the realities facing somebody coming home or in this situation. Tell us about this award that you guys got, because obviously this is something to be proud of.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, we're really proud. I mean, there's an organization called GotYourSix.org. You know, in the military, your six is your back, right? So if you're walking like
a
clock. So, you know, Got Your Back is basically the lingo there. And it's an amazing organization that's really doing their best to bridge the civilian military divide, which is, you know, there's, you know, at no point in human history has so much been asked of so few, to be honest with you. There's so few people who've served in the military. And so their goal is to bridge that and really, if you read, I mean, I went on their website, and if you read their kind of mission statement, it is exactly what my movie, you know, what Amir and Sam tried to do, is this idea of show a veteran who's, you know, in a different light. The veteran's fine. You know, he did his time. He just wants a fair shake. He comes back to his country. He just wants a fair shake. You know, that's all he wants. And people aren't used to seeing that a veteran depicted that way. And so they really, really got on board. And they, you know, for their first round of films to select, they selected two films to be stamped with this honor. And one was American Sniper and one was Amir and Sam. So it's nice. It's great company to be in, obviously, because American Sniper has been such a runaway hit that we're hoping, you know, we can draft off of some of that a little bit at least.
Yeah, right on, man. I mean, congratulations again on that. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
I mean, that's really fantastic. What I wanted to ask you about was, I love the ending to the film, and I thought it was very heartfelt and sweet, and I very much enjoyed it. And did you always have that concrete ending, or was there a different variation, or were you always set on that?
I mean, the ending, yeah, I mean, it's interesting, you know, I didn't know, so we reshot, like, so the ending, and I guess talk about the end of the movie, it's fine, but they were always going to, you know, the result was always going to be the same on the boat and all that stuff, the very, very end, that was always the same. The problem was in the original script, I say original script, and again, 33, 34 drafts, whatever, but, you know, I had written that final stand-up scene where he goes up on stage, he does stand-up comedy, he's really killing it, he looks at her in the audience, she is giving them the power, they kind of exchange a glance, and during his, like, stand-up comedy set, I flashed forward to the next day of them kind of taking off together, and I was just like, it was implied, it was this very kind of pretentious, horrible screenwriting mistake of the idea that the audience would just get it, you know? And so we shot it that way, and then in the movie, when I was cutting the movie together, you know, the movie was working really, really well, and I write in sequences, too. I write, the film is like 8 different sequences, basically. I write, every sequence is like 10 to 15 pages of, or 10 to 15 minutes of kind of action, and so the first 7 sequences were just humming. I mean, they were really great. I mean, I was really proud. The 8th sequence, that final sequence, was just an absolute nightmare, and it just wasn't working, and the comedy intercut of them leaving, people were confused, and what happened, and so then we added a letter for voiceover to help clarify. I said, and I went to my producer, I said, guys, listen, only thing that's going to make this better is if Sam, while on stage, he has to have an epiphany. He has to, in real time, we have to experience it with him. He has to ask her to leave. And I said, how great would it be as if, you know, the whole movie they've been outsiders, but how great would it be is if in that climactic moment, you know, they turn everybody else to outsiders, and they're on the inside by speaking Arabic. They kind of flip it, you know, and all of a sudden they're the insiders. Everybody else is the outsiders at the climax of the movie. And I pitched to my producers, and the they were like, I think that'll work. I don't know. And we're out of money. Oh. So I got my credit card, and Martin flew himself to New York on his own dime. You know, I was the writer, director, producer, production assistant, everything that day. And we did a pickup day of Martin giving that little speech at, so that final stand-up comedy scene is intercut from footage we shot the day of the original shoot day, and 6 months later, after he had shot another season of Silicon Valley, we had to reshave his beard off for that one thing. And so, but you can't tell it's 2 days cut together, at all, I don't think, right?
No.
Yeah, and that,
no, man.
But it's a great, to me, I like to tell that story because if there's any aspiring filmmakers out there, it's this idea of like, no matter how much you rethink stuff, you can always make things better. And I was in the edit and I just knew the film. And to be completely honest with you, if we would not have gone back and reshot that one half day little thing of him saying in Arabic, "Will you leave with me?" and her saying yes, if we would not have shot that, I don't think we would have sold the film.
Wow. Yeah, and it's, and I just wanted to point out the ending really got to me. I loved it. I loved how you went with your heart without spoiling it for people, because this is a very sweet film that people really should, check out. And again, without spoiling it, you go with your heart and you make a decision to have two people act exactly how they're feeling in the moment, which when you have your fade to black, the audience is left with some interesting questions about what will it be like for right. them in the future right. based on the decision that they've made, especially Martin's. And I can't help but feel that it is a wonderfully optimistic notion mixed into a fairly, not fairly, but a psychologically layered portrait of a guy who is trying to figure himself out and probably has some internal struggle going on. And I really appreciated the way that you handled that ending and went with your heart. So I'm glad to hear that it was never in question, that it was always your initial, it was always your intention.
Yeah, no, they were always going to, that was always the actual, the final shot, even, and everything was always, always planned and everything, the way the movie closes. It's just, just the actual that on stage, the stand-up comedy thing was not working. And when things aren't working, you have to just go with your gut, you go with your intuition. And I went back and reshot just a couple little, a half day, a few lines really, but it gives the, with the score and with the elaboration and the direct, the editing and the pacing of it, it gives that final scene the emotional punch that is needed.
Absolutely. And just so because this was your first film, and you had a chance, somebody like, I'm imagining someone like James Ponsoldt, who's had some success of late. How did he come aboard, and what was his sort of involvement in the film? And I'm bringing him up because he made another movie I feel is very underrated. It got good reviews, but I feel like not enough people saw The Spectacular Now. So I'm just curious to know, because I think he's also an interesting voice coming up. How did he get involved with this?
Well, so James and I went to film school together, and we were friends there. And then we moved out, and we went to grad school at Columbia together. And then we moved out to LA together around the same time. And he was one of those kids out of film school. He directed a movie he directed a feature right out of the gates. There's a few people who did features right out of film school, and he did one in like 05, 06. He got Nick Nolte. He got Nick Nolte and attached to a script of his while he was still at film school. And it was called Off the Black, and it played at Sundance, and it sold at Sundance. And then he moved out here with me, and we kind of all of us went through this this indie film drought, where all the indie film divisions shuttered and everything, online, streaming was shaking everything up. And, so we just played a lot of poker and wrote a lot of scripts. And then he had a film take off a few years ago called Smashed with Aaron and Mary Elizabeth Winstead. And he shot that. I mean, he wrote that script. Like, that was a part of – again, this gang of filmmakers out here in LA, we've got there's a nice group of a dozen or more of us out here. We all went to grad school back at Columbia, and, we all help each other out. And, he was fed up. He was trying to actually get a different script off the ground for years, like 4 or 5 years after Off the Black, and he couldn't do it. So he said, screw it. I'm going to write a $200,000 feature that I can shoot in my friend's house in Silver Lake, or Atwater, whatever, here in LA. And so he wrote this script called Smashed, And the budget ended up going up closer to like $500,000, I think, once he got the attachments of Mary Elizabeth Winstead and Aaron Paul. But anyways, I bring up all this backstory because it's kind of really interesting to hear about how it all comes together. So he gets that going. It gets into Sundance. While he's at Sundance, he gets pitched the idea of Spectacular Now. He says yes. He shoots it right after Sundance. He shot Spectacular Now. And so then one more year after that, when Spectacular Now premiered, which would have been two years ago, January 13, I had, you know, I had already had my script for about 2 years trying to push, you know, it was called Sam and Amir at the time. My distributors changed the title to Amir and Sam. They flopped it. I was pushing Sam and Amir, my script, and he was really hot. You know, James was really hot coming off Spectacular Now. He signed on to do 3 films with the Weinstein Company, and he's got all this other stuff going on. And he's like, is there anything I can do to help you? Basically, you know, I mean, we were talking about the thing, and, you know, I asked him, like, hey, would you be willing to sign on as a, you know, I knew I was going to go after Martin, and Martin was represented at UTA, the agency out here, and James was at UTA. And so I just knew, I said, James, would you mind coming on board and just, you know, shepherding, you know, you've done it 3 times now. You've had 3 films at Sundance, you know, would you be open to shepherding the project as like a creative VP? You know, there's 2 kinds of VPs for independent film. There's financial EPs, you know, financiers, and then there's kind of creative kind of, you know, EPs. And he was a creative EP. And, you know, I just really leaned on him for advice for the festivals and just, you know, putting the movie together. And so so that's kind of how it happened. So he said, of course. He had already read multiple drafts of the script over the, you know, years and everything. And so he was willing to help. And so he, when we sent it over to Martin's agents at UTA, you know, James was on that email chain. And they got right back to us, and I think it did help get Martin attached, and now James's agent ended up signing me, so we have the same agent now at UTA.
That's great.
Oh,
and
that's awesome.
And that's awesome to hear the camaraderie between people who are in film school, and, you know, the Hollywood is always about egos and about people trying to always better up somebody, so it's nice to hear that people are having that sort of community spirit in independent film, which, as you said, has gotten harder and harder to get made over the last, you know, 5-10 years because of a changing dynamic in the market. And now you're sort of, you know, needing to look in a variety of places for funding rather than just the, you know, the independent arm of a studio or something like that. And just sort of to maybe just to tie up things, and if you can talk about where you're at now, because after Amira and Sam getting the kind of attention that it's got, it will only continue to get more the year. What kind of things maybe do you have in the future, or what can we look forward to, or whatever you can say? I know some things you can't talk about. It hasn't hit Variety yet, but what can you talk about?
Yeah, no, I was hired to write a screenplay for Ridley Scott's company recently, and so that's really exciting, and so that'll be announced soon, and I'm actually almost done with the script. That's how these things work. They tend to announce them, you know, as late as they can to kind of keep them under wraps, you know, depending on what the politics of it is. But, yeah, so that's exciting. I mean, he's signed on to be an executive producer, and Jules Daly is the producer. She produced The Gray and with Liam Neeson, and, you know, she did Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford. She's like a big-time producer, and she's just one of the coolest people I've ever met. So I'm really lucky to be working with them. And the director, I'm writing it for a director, actually. The director is Henry Alex Rubin. He was an Oscar-nominated director of the documentary Murder Ball years ago about wheelchair rugby.
Murder Ball. Wow, I never forget that movie.
No, how could you? Yeah, it's amazing. So, yeah, Henry's kind of been a mentor of mine. I actually have 3 screenplays I've written for him to direct over the past 10 years. So we met back in New York.
You just haven't stopped. You just don't stop. You're just writing all day, every day.
I write from 9 to 1 every day, and then I set my afternoons aside for stuff like this. And I teach at USC. I teach film at night. I write during the mornings. I read and do take meetings in the afternoon, and I teach at night. And I I'll sleep when I'm dead, you know. It's an army term, an army phrase, I guess. But I've got 7 or 8 films. So my next film as a director, though, I'm going to do this, you know, I'm writing it right now. I'm putting it together, but I'm going to do this this kind of ground zero kind of, I don't want to say comedy, but this idea of this kind of absurdist, this kind of catch-22 kind of mash, kind of tonal, this idea of like the last guy who'd ever think is in charge of Ground Zero is in charge of Ground Zero, you know, based on my life experience. And, you know, guy who spends his days at Ground Zero, you know, in charge as the captain, you know, looking for terrorists that don't exist, and his nights performing stand-up comedy at UCB with, you know, Horatio Sands and Amy Poehler. And it's just kind of, it's an interesting, this is a coming-of-age story, you know, it's a coming-of-age story.
Sounds very provocative. And we're now going to get into, you know, we've gotten far enough away now from 9/11 so that the chorus of too soon is no longer, you know, going to be heard from people when we're talking about telling stories about one of the most important things that has ever happened in our lifetime.
Yeah, I was there, you know, so I don't really give a shit, you know.
You can't ignore real life, and it's a disservice to think that that didn't happen and it hasn't affected people on any number of levels. So I'm glad to see that you are staying topical with your choices, and this is excellent. Really, honestly, congratulations for all of the success that Amira and Sam has received. It's well deserved, and we definitely look forward to keeping tabs on your career. It sounds like you will have a lot of things to show for yourself, which is very exciting.
Oh, well, let's hope so. Yeah, absolutely. I just, you know, you can't, you gotta, you know, like you're saying, I mean, if there are any aspiring filmmakers out there, I mean, that's the only advice I could give is, you know, exactly what you're saying. Don't stop. You know, I hold myself to a quota. I try to write for 20 hours a week. You know, like I said, you know, 4 hours a day, 5 days a week is usually what I do. But, you know, you just have to keep churning out. You know, one thing I realized when I moved to LA was like, if you don't have a new piece of property, if you don't have a new script, every 3 to 6 months, you know, at least 2 to 3 a year, you know, if you don't have 2 to 3 new scripts a year, then just hang it up.
This has been incredible, man. This is great. And the film you're referring to that's going to be hopefully your next feature as a writer director sounds absolutely amazing.
Yeah,
honestly, man, that sounds like right up my alley. That sounds fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, if I can make that funny, you know, like taking serious issues, you know, I mean, again, like even with Amira Sam, you know, you're looking at, you know, veteran reintegration and refugee, you know, and racism and stuff. If I can make that funny, I think I can do. I mean, the shit at Ground Zero was just, I mean. Yeah, I mean, I'm not commenting on the actual act at all. It's just literally...
Right, no, not at all.
It's how a country, you know, really, I mean, without getting too much into the idea, but it's how both a country and this young man both experienced the kind of the toughest moments of their lives together in parallel and how they both react to those moments. So.
Oh, that sounds so good.
Well, let's hope.
Yeah, that sounds great. I can't wait.
I'll come back and on the podcast. We'll talk about it on the podcast, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime you want to come back, man, you're more than welcome.
Cool.
Well, I think that's about it. So, yeah, I just want to say thanks again for coming on to talk about your latest film, Amira and Sam. And we will be posting the links for it and as well as Nick's review and where people can find it to see it. And and you just to reiterate again, you said July 5th, it'll be available on Amazon Prime to stream?
Yeah, we did a 2-year exclusive streaming deal with Amazon Prime starting, I think right after 4th of July. Yes, yeah, for 2 years. So if you have Amazon Prime, I think there's like 49 million people for Amazon Prime, which is exciting. So hopefully, you know.
Yeah,
hopefully,
I have Amazon Prime. I rented it on Vudu tonight.
Oh, you did Vudu? Okay, it's on Vudu. It's on iTunes. It's on Vudu. It's on Amazon now.
I did see it. Just want to make sure you know. I saw it on disc through Netflix.
You know what? I'm sorry. It's on Netflix disc. It's not on Net. Every time someone says Netflix, I always think streaming. It's on. You're right. It's
well,
on.
I'm
Netflix.
The last person.
I know.
No, I'm
Nick's
the
last person in the world that isn't streaming Netflix.
That's hilarious. That's hilarious.
I prefer physical media. I'm all for the disc and seeing it for sure in the proper aspect ratio with the full surround.
Yeah. But you have no idea the possibilities you're missing.
I understand
streaming.
The benefits of streaming, thank you. But I will take the disc as long as I can get a disc. That's my first choice. But I just wanted to make sure you know that Netflix is sending out discs still, and Amira and Sam is in rotation.
I love it. Awesome. Yeah, I might just order it. Just to, I don't know. So,
should take a picture with your red envelope.
Take a selfie with your red envelope. Exactly.
I've never taken a selfie, and if I do, please shoot me.
Awesome.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Sean.
Great, man. Thanks for coming on.
Probably a good way to end it. Okay, guys, take care.